Okay, so again, I kind of mentioned that history is kind of important to me. You know, as a little guy, you guys probably can't imagine me as a little guy. I'm pretty big right now. I used to love history. I think I was telling somebody the other day, I used to just read the encyclopedia. I used to pick out, you know, especially history books. My mom's attic before she moved was full of books, history and all sorts of other different things. I just loved history. You know, but you're a little kid, right? You don't exactly know. I didn't really understand that America, that there was other countries. You know, I heard Europe, I knew Britain, but it's like, yeah, you know, really just America. All that other stuff's just window dressing. And then, you know, you start getting into school, you start learning about things at school. And boy, in school these days, do they always teach about the exceptionalism? You know, in the early 80s, they were starting to teach me America's evil. America does this. America does that. I started listening to music that echoed the same things, and I really started losing my desire to understand American history. And it was kind of a, you know, now that I look back, it was kind of a dark time in my life, a time that, you know, you've heard all these great things, and then it's been contradicted by teachers and by professors and by musicians and by politicians and by you know, actors and actresses, celebrities, and they're going against the things that you believed as a young child. And, you know, how many of us, there's no little kids in here, how many of us really didn't recover very smooth when we found out Santa Claus didn't exist, right? So to find out all of a sudden that this great country that your aunts and, or your uncles and your fathers and, you know, went to war to defend, and to find out all of a sudden that people are telling you this is an evil country, we do terrible things, that was tough on me. Now, some things in my life changed to make, you know, to make me kind of come around. Number one, I joined the Air Force. So when you go into the service, and there's a couple of others of us that have been in the service. It's not all just PT, physical, you know, stuff. They actually sit you down and they teach you history. So you spend a little time in history. The other thing is, I got married and had kids. So now history is starting to mean something because we always heard that if you don't learn your history, you're doomed to repeat it, right? So even if America was an evil country, I need to understand it. I need to learn it because I got kids now. I need to protect them, right? And the last thing that kind of changed things around is I gave my life to the Lord. Giving my life to the Lord and starting to understand why He created this country. What He, you know, what was the basis behind it? So, you know, that is the backdrop. Again, my love of history started kicking in. And how many of you guys podcast? There you go. Megan Podcast. No one else in this church downloads podcasts. Oh, no. Oh, that's what you were. Megan was claiming to be an ex-pothead. Oh, let me enunciate. No one else tell on yourself about stuff like that. How many of you podcast? Download either discussions or Hillary, Dennis, you guys download the messages that we put out there on the website. That's kind of a podcast in some sense. Well, I'm kind of a, you know, again, a technology guy and a history geek. So I started downloading and podcasting the Colonial Williamsburg podcast. How many of you are familiar with Colonial Williamsburg? Josh, that's back in his neck of the woods. So the one thing that struck me as I was listening, and it basically was a podcast where historians would go through and they kind of tell of what was going on in life in Colonial Williamsburg. And one of the things that struck me was how much their lives centered around their church. How much the church was their focus of where they got their news. It was where they socialized. It was where they went find husbands and wives. It was where they went to do business deals. It was where they went to do everything. It was the center of town. I mean, they don't really teach that in high school history or college history. How many of us ever heard of the Black Shirt Regiment or Black Robe Regiment? How many heard before David Barton started talking about it through your history classes? Not many. But, you know, that tie-in with the Colonial Williamsburg and the center of their city, the center of their town really being the church, their social hub, their business hub, their spiritual hub, that ties into these Black Robe ministers that David Barton talks about when he talks about the Black Robe Regiment. I had never heard of it. And, you know, again, I read everything I could get my hands on about the Revolution. My kids will attest, they probably get sick of it. I watch every single revolutionary documentary that comes on TV that I can see. Never heard of it. But it was a very important part of life. And it was a very important part of our revolution as well. In the decades, even the generations prior to the revolution, a lot of these pastors were standing up in the pulpit and they were declaring, that all men are created equal. No taxation without representation. These guys were talking about this. One pastor, I believe his name is John Wise, he was talking about this stuff in 1687. He was given messages about these different aspects of what we now call, what we call our Constitution or our Declaration of Independence. These pastors fought against the Stamp Act. Who would have ever heard of the Stamp Act? All right, some of us history buffs. They fought against, the Tea Act, the different things, all the different things that kind of caused the spark of revolution. There was two pastors in particular that early on, try to find their names here, of course, trying to use technology to make sure I have the right information. But they, there we go, Tim Whitfield, or George Whitfield and Tim Dwight, two reverends in colonial America. George Whitfield being a pretty prominent name in American history, they actually had been advocating separation from Great Britain long before your John Adams and those guys, right? These guys were coming through their pulpits. John Adams himself was quoted as saying, when the revolutionary started, that the pulpits had thundered, that the impetus for this revolution was coming from the pastors. So this was, again, decades before, in some cases generations before, that these pastors were preaching about all the freedoms, all the rights that turned into our Bill of Rights, into our Constitution, into our Declaration of Independence. And so, again, a lot of these ideas that we've been told by politicians, we've been told by historians, we've been told by commentators, that our country is not a Christian nation. I mean, right now our president has said that. Our country is not a Christian nation. And now what I'm going to do here, that's been a long introduction, I'm going to go through and I'm going to use the founders' words themselves, their notes, and I'm going to show you where they believed that it was a Christian nation, and that it had to be a Christian nation for it to work. So again, one of the ways we track, we do it, or we, I don't personally do it, but when they had gone through the Bible to determine whether it was actually true, the true accounts, say, of the Gospels and of the Epistles, one of the things they did was they took writings that happened within a generation of the actual Bible being written to kind of validate, right? Because if I write something, say I write something about Kevin, and Kevin's still alive to refute it, we're going to find a refutation, if I can make up words up here. So within a generation, if it's a lie, if it's an untruth, you'll hear that. It'll come back. And that's kind of how that's one of the techniques that people use to validate that the Gospels were actually true. Well, we can do the same thing in history. And within a generation of the Revolution, and to some extent within just years, major publications including American Quarterly Register Magazine, the Bibliotheca Sacra, which is a British periodical, a number of historians, Alice Baldwin, Clinton Rossiter, they were publishing works that were saying that the ministers of the United States were the push behind the revolution. Again, one of them was a British periodical. So even within a generation of the revolution itself, we're being told that the revolution was pushed. It was fueled by from the pulpits of the colonial pastors. And so now, if that wasn't true, we would have heard a lot of refutes then, instead of now, 200 years later, right? 200 years later, they're trying to tell us that the Bible had nothing to do with our founding. But right after it happened, that's what they were saying. So then, as we got into the Revolution in 1772, Reverend Wise had printed, he had come up with a couple of books. And so he had written, I'm going to find the names of his books so you can look it up yourself. We'll skip it because I can't find it in my notes. So, technology. So, but Reverend Wise had created a couple of books, and he had written some sermons. And in the colonial period, they had sermons that were called election sermons. Like right now, if Pastor Duane got up here during an election and pretty much, he's got to walk a line on whether he can tell you who to vote for, whether he can tell you his opinion, whether he can tell you positives or negatives about the people that are running for him. But back then, oh no. Back then, they would get up in their pulpits and they would tell you who was right for you. They would tell you who had bad ideas, who was going against the Constitution, and most importantly, who was going against the laws of God. Because, let's be honest, that's the important thing, right? So, in 1772, they reprinted an essay from John Wise. And they started sending that out amongst the colonies. And again, it was said in 1864 that some of the most glittering sentences in the immortal Declaration of Independence are almost literal quotations from this 1772 reprinted essay from John Wise. And at the time, it was used as a political textbook in the great struggle of freedom. So they're saying that phrases from this political, or not political, from this theological pamphlet that was put out and reprinted in 1772 by John Wise was where they got a lot of the phrases from the Declaration of Independence. So then as the war, you know, as the revolution started building up, pastors played another role. How many of you have ever seen the movie The Patriot? It's one of my favorite movies, probably not as historically accurate. I probably shouldn't be using it as an example. But one of the things the pastor did, I think he was played by the guy from Benson. I can't remember his name. But he was in his pulpit, and when the war started getting going, he recruited people from his church. He was more effective, and not particularly him, but some of the pastors in the colonial times were more effective military recruiters than the army recruiters themselves. Because, again, if you're fighting for what you really believe, if you're fighting for the truth of the Lord, then it's much more passionate than, yeah, we're fighting for this scrap of ground, right? So pastors fought. They took up arms. They recruited, they drilled. There's kind of an anecdote that there was two pastors that from the Boston area that as they heard the Battle of Bunker Hill starting, that they were actually in their pulpits preaching, and when they heard the guns go off, they stopped, grabbed their guns, which they happened to have on the pulpit with them, I promise you, I don't have one up here with me. But they grabbed their guns, told their guys, let's go, and they went off to the Battle of Bunker Hill. Don't know if that's necessarily true or not, but it is an important kind of anecdote. Now, the other thing, as we started going in our fledgling country, we're always being told to keep politics and church separate, right? But there were many, many reverends that were part of the Continental Congress. Dr. John Witherspoon was one of the most popular. He also served in over 100 congressional committees. Other ministers who served in Continental Congress were Reverend Joseph Montgomery, Reverend Hugh Williamson, Reverend John Zolby, and there was actually more. So then another important thing, an aspect in our lives as a young country, or soon-to-be country, is who was responsible for the education of people back then? The church. The church was responsible for the education. It was responsible for the understanding that it took illiterate people well-versed in the teaching of the Bible to sustain free and enlightened government. Public education was started by Quakers. The Old Deluder Satan Act, who have ever heard that? That is our nation's first public education law was passed in 1647. So, public education, how many of you, especially young people that have just got out of public education, how often is there a discussion of Satan and God and angels in school? Very little, right? Separation of church and state. But why would our first public school act be called the Old Deluder Satan Act? Because in their minds, ignorance was a deception from the devil. And in order to be a free people, in order to be able to sustain your own government, you had to be educated, right? So, again, we constantly hear that this isn't a godly nation. This isn't a nation founded on Christian principles. The University of Houston did a 10-year research study. 10 years. I don't think I've had a job. That's a long time to do a research study. And the research study was of 15,000 documents from the American founders, and they determined that 34% of their quotations came directly from the Bible. 34%. For a country that's not built on the Christian principles, a third of the quotations in our founding documents come from the Bible. That's hard to do. Those two things just don't jive, right? And given that, the next three highest percentages were from Baron Charles Montague, I believe I'm saying his name right, who was a conservative Christian who declared that a government based on Christianity is superior because Christianity promotes a more moderate form of government. So that was the second highest quoted person in all the founding documents. So the Bible and a conservative Catholic who believed that Christianity was the root of a good government. The next guy, Sir William Blackstone, he felt the law must be in accordance with the law of nature and the revealed law, which he described as the law found in biblical scriptures. So now we're at another level. So the top three quotations in all the founding documents were all from either the Bible itself or people that believed in the Bible and believed it was the best way to form a government. And then the fourth most quoted person was John Locke. We've all heard of him and his two treatises on civil government. And he quoted the Bible himself in that book 84 times, primarily Genesis. He developed the concept of a social compact. Stressed the importance of natural laws, natural rights, which he found in the Bible. Okay, so again, we're finding through the writings of our founders that those that are telling us now that our government's not a Christian nation, or that our country is not a Christian country, not a Christian nation, that's revisionist history. The people themselves are telling us. Who's heard of Noah Webster? He's a founding father. He was an educator. He had this to say about the moral principles contained in the scriptures. He said, the scriptures ought to form the basis of our civil constitutions and laws. All the miseries and evils which men suffer from vice, crime, ambition, injustice, oppression, slavery, and war proceed from their despising or neglecting the precepts contained in the Bible. How many of you guys watch the news lately? All those things he listed, all those negative things he listed, are happening today. And what's happening more and more today? A despising of the Bible. We're, you know, as a nation, we are going out of our way to put down the Bible, to entrap Christians, to tell us that what we believe is bigoted, to tell us that what we believe is old-fashioned, that we're hurtful, that we're terrible people, right? Almost the same things that were happening to me when I was a kid learning about history, right? It was, the U.S. is evil, now it's Christians are evil. I don't think we're evil, are we? I don't think we've changed. But what Noah Webster said is, all that stuff is a result of despising the Word. That if we love the Word, then those things wouldn't happen. Those things wouldn't appear. Another thing that I studied and read is how much I started digging into the source documents for the Constitution. Now, most of us have gone through school and have had to write research papers. The most boring thing on earth, right? You have the paper itself is great. But in the back, where you got a list, or I got this piece of information, which I couldn't copy exactly. I had to paraphrase, otherwise I'd get in trouble for plagiarism, and you have to list all that in the back. And by the time your 8-page, 10-page paper, you got that bibliography in the back, and it's 32 pages, right? They also did that with the founding documents, with the Constitution. They didn't list them in there, because that's a lot of handwriting. We got computers and stuff now, so it's a little easier, but they actually listed in the source documents for the Constitution, for the Declaration of Independence, for many of the amendments, besides the Bible itself, they also listed sermons that were preached. Because back then, what would happen on important occasions, and I mentioned earlier, the election sermons that these preachers would write, they would actually write them out. They would put them together, they'd print them up as pamphlets, and they'd pass them out. Because, again, back then, it's not as easy to get from Apple Valley, where I live, to St. Paul for church, right? So maybe you couldn't come up to hear this big famous preacher that's going to do this election ceremony. So what they'd do is they'd print it out, bind it, and then they'd pass them out so people could all hear what that guy had to say. They didn't have the internet. You know, now we could all sit in our homes and everything Pastor Duane says, for the most part, in the pulpit, we can get, right? But back then, they had to print them out. So they would do that, and they used these printed pamphlets as source documents for our Constitution. One of them is The True Scripture Doctrine Concerning Some Important Points of the Christian Faith by Jonathan Dickinson. And that was in 1741. So again, that shows that earlier, decades, generation earlier, the pastors, the preachers are already starting to talk about things that would be important during our formation as a country. The works of Jonathan Edwards was listed as one. He was a Great Awakening preacher, American-born Great Awakening preacher. The sermons of George Whitefield. He also was a celebrity traveling preacher during the Great Awakening. They used his works. The works of John Wesley. And from Elisha Williams in 1744, The Essential Rights and Liberties of Protestants. So, again, we're, even in his title, The Essential Rights and Liberties. Rights and liberties, that's what our Declaration of Independence, that's what our Constitution is formed on. So those were things that were being preached out of pulpits in New England long before, again, this was almost 30 years before the Civil War started. So one of the things I wanted to do, and I think if Jed is ready, I took some of these founding documents and I took some of the source information, and what I want to do is kind of go through some of them. So the idea of the sovereign authority of God. Oh, there we go. Sovereign authority of God. Not the sovereign authority of the state or of man. That information is found in the Mayflower Contract, or Compact, I'm sorry, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, it's on our money, it's in the oaths we take when we go to court, it is in the Pledge of Allegiance, though some say that, you know, that is a more recent addition, maybe in the 50s, I think, when they added under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. And it also mentions God in the Constitution of all 50 states. Now, the Founding Fathers found this right, this authority of God in many places, including Exodus 18:16, Exodus 23, 2 Chronicles 7:14. Please don't try to turn to all these. I'm just going to list them. Daniel 4:32, Isaiah 9:6-7, Acts 5:29, Colossians 1:15-20, and Psalms 83:18. But then also, there was some, if you want to go to, I believe this is Acts. Make sure I have my right information here. Acts 5:29. Peter and the apostles answered by saying they must obey God rather than men. And Jed, if you could go back to the Exodus 23. You shall have no gods, no other gods before me. That sounds like the sovereignty of God to me, right? Our founding fathers found fit to put that in our Constitution, in our Declaration. The next piece, the existence of objective moral values, absolute truth and sanctity of life. That's found in the Declaration of Independence as unalienable rights, the right to life, and also self-evident truths. And again, a whole other list of verses, which I probably shouldn't list out, but most importantly, Exodus 20:1-17 is the Ten Commandments. I mean, that is the basis of our moral law, right? It's the basis of our natural law as well. And if we go to Isaiah 5:20-21, this was another verse that they quoted for this. It says, "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and shrewd in their own sight." Sounds like our country today, doesn't it? How often are we hearing now that what we believe to be true and has been true since God created this earth is now false? What God told us is good is now we're being told it's evil. There is a basis for an objective law. And in the eyes of our founders, it was the law of the Lord. It was not what's popular in people's minds. It's not what so many people want to change their Facebook pitcher to represent. It's not a flag. It's not any of these other things. It is the Word of God is the basis for our objective moral law. And our founders knew that, and they put it in their documents. The next thing is the rule of law, not the authority of man. I kind of touched on that earlier, right? We've decided that we're going to make right and wrong based on what man thinks is right and wrong. What these guys in Washington decide that all the people would rather have is law, whether it's right with God or not. But our founders put in the Declaration and in the Constitution the rule of law, not the authority of man. Some of the verses they quote in that are Exodus 18, 24 through 27, Deuteronomy 17 through 20, Matthew 5, 17 through 18. And so if you could turn to Matthew 17, I'll pull up my document so I can read it here. Say Christ came to fulfill the law. Verse 17, do not think that I have come to abolish the law of the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, until heavens and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot will pass from the law until it's all accomplished. Again, that is a verse that our founding fathers determined that that was the rule of law that they should put into our Constitution. On to the next one. All men are created equal. Where do we find that? The Declaration of Independence. Okay, that is one of the basis things, one of the earliest things in our Declaration, that all men are created equal. Galatians 3:28, 1 Peter 2:17, Genesis 1:26, Acts 10:34 through 35, and Acts 17:26. All verses that our founders found the equality of man in. And so Galatians 3:28 says, there's neither Jew nor Greek, there's neither slave nor free, there's no male and female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. Now, at the time these guys were writing that, we had slaves. Again, I can't attest to why they could pull that all men are created equal yet still hold slaves. But a lot of the documentation that I've read has said that our founders, Thomas Jefferson, George Jefferson, oh my, Wheezy and all those other guys, George Washington, that they actually added into their wills, because actually in some of our, I'm going to go off on a rabbit hole here, I go. Some of our states, some of our municipalities had laws in them where a man could not release his slave. So these guys may have actually hated the institution of slavery, but they were legally bound not to release their slaves. And they found loopholes. George Washington actually released his slaves in his will, because that was one way he could get around that, especially in Virginia, where a lot of these founders were from. That's a southern state. Slavery was an important institution, and they were bound by law not to release their slaves. But again, George Washington released his slaves on his death. It was the only loophole he could. So while they may have understood biblically that all men are created equal, for one reason or another, that slavery thing still kind of sticks with a lot of people. A lot of people, it bothers. There's a lot of people I've heard that don't want to celebrate 4th of July because my people were slaves at that point in time. This is going to be an ad lib. It has nothing to do with the Bible, but I would much rather be where I am now and my forefathers have gone through what they went through than to be in some of those African nations now, right? I mean, we're free We're free to learn. We're free to get jobs. We're free to worship God, which over there you can't. Over there, some of those places in Africa, people are being chopped up for celebrating Christ. So, again, that's a little side note. I can say I'm glad because I didn't have to live through it, but I'm glad some of my ancestors did live through it so I can be here in this free nation. So, on to the next thing before I get myself in trouble. Three branches of government. Can anybody here tell me what the three branches of government is? This isn't a Jimmy Kimmel skit. What was it? And what do those three branches of government do? Make laws. Enforce laws. Pass laws. So the founders used Isaiah 33:22 as the basis for that. If we can bring that up. For the Lord is our judge, the Supreme Court. He's our lawgiver, which is the Congress. They create the laws. He is our king, which would be our executive branch. He will save us. So the idea of a three-pronged government system comes straight out of the Bible. Those are the three things that God is to us. So our founders wrote that into the Constitution, wrote that into our government, and they quoted Isaiah directly for it. Here's the sticky one, the next one. Church protection from the state, but still an influencer of the state. Separation of church and state. We hear that every time a kid wants to pray in church or school. If they pray in church, you should probably let them. Every time we want to take down Ten Commandment plaques from courthouses. Separation of church and state never existed. It was a phrase written by Thomas Jefferson in a letter, not in any of our official founding documents, to a congregation in which he was promising the separation of church from state would be, church would be protected from the state, but that the church would still have influence over the state. Not the other way around. Not that we don't want any form of Christianity in the public sphere. Not that you can't put a cross on a public, in public ground, which is what it's been reinterpreted to do. Thomas Jefferson actually held church service in the Capitol. If he believed that you shouldn't have any mention of Christianity in a public place, would he have held church service in the Capitol? No. So, this is found in the First Amendment, obviously. And again, there was a whole slew of verses that and passages that our founding fathers used for this. But the one I want to kind of go into, and I'm not going to read it all because it's pretty long, but it's 2 Samuel 12:1-18. And in 2 Samuel, In that part of 2 Samuel, the prophet Nathan is coming to the king David to rebuke him for having killed a man so he could get his wife. The man of God is going to the king to tell him what he's doing is wrong. The man of God is influencing the state, not the other way around. David does not have the authority to make Nathan not a man of God. He doesn't have he has the authority to kill Nathan if he wants, but that wouldn't stop him. But he does not have the authority to stop Nathan from doing what Nathan is doing. But Nathan now does have the authority to walk into the kingdom, walk into his palace and tell him, hey, you're messing up, partner. But for some reason, we're being told as Christians, keep your Christianity at church. You can't go into your public place and tell your politician or your congressman that you are messing up in the eyes of God. We're told we can't do that. But that's not the basis that our founding fathers, through 2 Samuel, they wrote that in. That we're protected from the government, but we should be able to influence the government. You're not going to hear that. People aren't going to like that because we make them nervous. We make them nervous because when we're around, and Pastor Dwayne talks about this all the time, he'd be around family members that would feel like he was kind of coming down on me. He hadn't said anything. But it's our holiness and our righteousness that they're looking at, and they're seeing a reflection of themselves in it, and it convicts them. So they don't want to hear us. They don't want us having influence in the government because it convicts them for the wrong they're doing. I could get myself in trouble on that, so let's move on. Next. The Republican form of government and a warning against kings in favor of godly rulers. That's found in our Constitution and the biblical basis behind it in Exodus 18, Deuteronomy 1, Judges 8, 1 Samuel 8, Proverbs 11:14, Proverbs 24:16. And so now if we can pull up the Proverb or the Samuel 8, 1 Samuel 8. This is, again, I'm not going to read it because it's a whole chapter and you guys don't want to hear me reading the whole chapter. But Israel demanded a king. We all remember this story. Israel was ruled by judges. But they wanted, and the judges were, for the most part, men and women of God. But they demanded a king because all the other nations had a king. And when they went to go get a king, of course, they wanted the biggest guy. They wanted the strongest guy. They wanted the most handsome guy. They didn't care so much whether, you know, how close he was to the Lord, right? And Samuel, the prophet at the time, gave a warning. And he said, "These will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariot, and to be his horsemen, and to run before his chariots. And he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands, commanders of fifties, and some to plow good ground and reap his harvest, and to make his implements of war and equipment of his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards, olive orchards, and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your grain and of your vineyards, and give them to his officers and his servants. He will take your male servants and female servants and the best of your young men and your donkeys, and he'll put them to his work. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you shall be his slaves. And in that day you will cry out because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day." So our founders not only used the current kings of their days to show you what monarchies and kingdoms and people with absolute power could do. They went back and they used Saul, basically, to say, look, this is our warning. To give one man such rule over your lives. Instead, They formed a Republican government where we're allowed to vote in representatives that are supposed to vote in their body with our best interests in mind. Supposed. Now, whether that happens or not is another story. We'll get to that a little later. The next thing. How am I doing on time here? Is the importance of self-governing and that the family being the base unit of government. That's found in the 1st, 2nd, 9th, and 10th Amendments. The family is your first unit of government. Matthew 18:15-18. Galatians 5:16-26. 1 Corinthians 6:1-11. 1 Timothy 3:1-5. Titus 2:1-8. All verses that our founding fathers gave as a representation of this. And so now if we go into Galatians 5:16-26, it says, "But I say, walk by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the desires of the flesh. For the desires of the flesh are against the Spirit, and the desires of the Spirit are against the flesh. For these are opposed to each other, to keep you from doing things that you want to do. But if you are led by the Spirit, you are not under the law. Now the works of the flesh are evident: sexual immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, fits of anger, rivalries, dissensions, divisions, and envy, drunkenness, orgies, and things like these. I warn you, as I've warned you before, that those who do such things will not inherit the kingdom of God. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against these things there is no law. And those who belong to Christ Jesus have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. If we live by the Spirit, let us also keep in step with the Spirit. Let us not become conceited, provoking one another, envying one another." It's a lot of words, but in basic English, if we live by the Spirit, if we govern ourselves by the Spirit, we won't have any trouble with the law. We don't need the law. We don't need politicians. We don't need governments to hold us to do what's right if we live by the Spirit. It's when you don't live by the Spirit, which is the opposite, when we need civil law. So if we as a people, and not just us in this church, but everywhere, if we all live by the Spirit and we all governed ourselves by the Spirit, there's really no need for the law of man. There's no need for governments, but we know we don't, right? We know we struggle. But the important part is that if you do live by the laws of the Spirit, that you're not subject to the laws of man, right? So, on to our next point, the establishment of justice found in the Declaration of Independence. And this is Romans 13:3-4, according to our founders. "For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad." Kind of just what I was saying earlier, if we live by the Spirit, we're not going to be harassed by the laws of man if we maintain the laws of God. "Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval." On a slight side note, I have 3 kids. When they were younger, they used to always, "Why am I getting in trouble? Why am I getting in trouble? Why are you doing this to me?" And my standard answer, which my wife is probably can repeat in her head right now, "If you just did what I told you to, we wouldn't be having any of this problems," right? And God's telling us the same thing. He's laid down his law, and if we follow his law, then while, yeah, we may deal with consequences of man, and we may deal with consequences of sinners, we won't have to deal with his consequences. And trust me, people yelling at you, people calling you a bigot, people, you know, doing whatever else they'll do for you following the Lord here on earth, even to the point where they'll kill you, which they do in some other countries. None of that is anything compared to the consequences you'll get if you don't live his law in the afterlife. So do what you want to me, because I'm not spending eternity in the fiery pit. I get too hot when it's hot outside here, and this is Minnesota. Got the air conditioning on, and the pits of hell is no place for me. All right, we just got a few more here. The next one is property rights. These are found, this is found in the Fifth Amendment, and most expressly, our founding fathers found the rights to property in, they used the Ten Commandments again. The commandment, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness against your neighbor, and thou shalt not covet your neighbor's house, or covet his wife, or covet a whole bunch of other stuff, that his ox and his cat and his goat. But the whole principle there is, you know, we hear a lot of things these days and probably earlier about communal. It's all ours. Everything on earth is everybody's. Community property. The whole basis behind communism, right? That everything is owned as a group. Everything is owned as a whole. That no one is better than anybody else. But according to the laws of God, somebody thinks somebody has something nice, because otherwise why would you steal it? People don't steal junk, right? They don't steal things that they already have. You don't lie on your neighbor unless you're trying to achieve something, right? You certainly don't want somebody's house if it's raggedier than yours, do you? So the concept, or his ox, or his goat, or whatever it is else, somebody steals my goat, they probably can keep it. I don't need a goat. But the concept of actually having private property, that things not being held in common, failed experiment in the early settlement of the United States, I believe it was Jamestown, where they came here and they decided they were going to do everything in common. They were going to hold all their stuff in common. And they were going to work the fields together, and everybody was going to get the same exact share of the fields they worked. But guess what happened? Well, John over here has got that bursitis acting up, so he's not going to work today. But everybody else working the field, John's going to get the same amount. Well, Tom over here has got that thing in his elbow, you know, that tennis elbow's flaring up. He's not going to work. So-and-so's not going to work. Eventually, there was less people working in the fields than there were people reaping the benefits. And guess what happens to a field when that happens? All of a sudden, starvation. Because if somebody is able to get what you have without working the same way you work for it, they don't value it. They do not value something you don't work for. Another lesson, my kids are probably sitting over there rolling their eyes thinking, my God, will this man stop talking about this? But again, that is the failure in communism, right? Because if you're not willing to work for it, eventually you'll work for it. But when human nature states, when you can start realizing the same benefit as the guy really breaking his neck, and you don't have to, you'll do it. It takes a disciplined person. It takes a godly person to keep working when he thinks he can get the same thing for less. And unfortunately, and part of the thing that goes with the communism, especially in modern days, is they try to take away God. If communism was going to ever work, God would have to be there. Because without him, it certainly wouldn't work. Okay, next. Biblical liberty and free enterprise, found in the Declaration of Independence, again in a number of verses, specifically 1 Peter 2:16. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. This is a free country, I can do whatever I want. You ever heard that on the news? Somebody doing something wrong and say, you can't stop me, this is a free country. The Bible says, don't use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Don't use that freedom as a... Yo, never mind. On to the next. I could go on for... There's a rant in there, but I don't want to go there. Next, creation rather than evolution. Found in the Declaration of Independence. Obviously found in Genesis 1:1. Now this is our founding fathers have quoted Genesis 1:1 as the reason why they opened up the Declaration of Independence the way they did. It says, the creation of the world. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. It didn't say, in the beginning, some little amoeba in some black mass of water came out and became a man. The earth didn't form out of nothing. God created the heavens and the earth. And so, because he created the heavens and earth and he created us with certain unalienable rights. The next point. Servanthood, not political power. The basic concept of the public servant. Now, our founding fathers didn't intend for us to be the slaves of our political class. I just mentioned the words of Samuel in warning about kings. Well, we don't necessarily have a king in this country, but we've turned our politicians and we've turned the people that are running these think tanks and the people that are running these government institutions into pseudo kings. And we've all become their slaves. We were warned about giving them too much power. We were told that they would make us their slaves, that they'd take our kids. You know, back in the 60s and whatnot when they were having a draft. Isn't that taking your kids to put before the chariot? You know, isn't having to work till April 15th so we can, you know, what is it? Is it April 15th? It might even be longer than April 15th now. We have to work so much, 4 months into the year, before we've paid off our tax obligations to run a big bloated government, because we've let them grow into little groups of pseudo-kings that we are now the slaves of. Because we didn't follow what the founding fathers put in the Constitution. So if we go to Philippians 2:7, the servanthood of our leaders in the minds of our founding fathers was to be a representation of what Christ did for us when he came onto the earth. Philippians 2:7 said he emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. So if God himself can bring himself onto the earth and become a human and empty himself to serve us, why are we letting some half-baked politician treat us like we owe him something or her something? Why are we letting them get away with treating us like chattel? Because they have the power. We've given them our power. We've handed them the keys. And, you know, the only way to do anything about it is through Christ. We have to get back to being a Christian nation, one that we know we really are. I'm going to wrap up here. Of course, I've gone a lot longer than what I expected. Quick thought between our revolution and the French Revolution. Our revolution was based on godly principles. Since the time of our revolution in 1776, we've had one constitution. We've had one flag. It hasn't changed. I mean, we've added stars, but that's growth. That's different from change. French Revolution, because it wasn't founded on the sovereignty of God, it was founded more on the sovereignty of man. Voltaire's philosophy that he tried to replace biblical principles with this sovereignty of man principle. They've had seven constitutions since 1789. Their flag changed constantly up until recently with whoever was in power. Our revolution, once the British gave up, we were done, right? It was over. The French Revolution, they went on to slaughter anybody that was not on their side. The winning side cut the heads off 40,000 people after the war. That's not of God. That's why they're still struggling, right? That's why they're in their seventh and probably soon to be in their eighth constitution. Christianity is one of the most important parts of capitalism. John Adams himself said, but capitalism only works when run by a moral and religious people. John Adams said, we have no government armed with the power capable of contending with human passions unbridled by morality and religion. Avarice, ambition, revenge, gallantry would break the strongest cords of our Constitution as a whale goes through a net. Our Constitution was made only for moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. The people are telling us our country's not a godly country. It's not a country founded on the principles of Christ. Our founding fathers themselves, through, my professor-like run through of all these documents, they're telling us themselves that they found the information that they based our country on in the Bible. They told us themselves that unless we were a Christian people, our government, our form of economics would collapse. We're starting to see the results of taking God out of our country, aren't we? The rule of law is starting to collapse around us. We're being told what's good is bad and what's bad is good. We're being told that as Christians, we're not allowed to participate in public debate. We're not allowed to be part of the influence of this government. And that's not true. It's not true to what our founders tried to put together. So, just in conclusion, Reverend Charles Finney, who was the leader of the Second Great Awakening, reminded the ministers in his day, "Brethren, our preaching will bear its legitimate fruits. If immorality prevails in the land, the fault is ours in a great degree. If there is a decaying conscience, the pulpit is responsible for it. If the public press lacks moral discrimination, the pulpit is responsible for it. If the church is degenerate and worldly, the pulpit is responsible for it. If the world loses its interest in religion, the pulpit is responsible for it. If Satan rules in our halls of legislation, the pulpit is responsible for it. If our politics become so corrupt that the very foundations of our government are ready to fall away, the pulpit is responsible for it. Let us not ignore this fact, my dear brethren. Let us lay it to heart and be thoroughly awake to our responsibilities in respect to the morals of this nation." Now, fortunately, we don't have this problem here in this body. Pastor Duane gets up here, and he lays down the truth day in and day out. And from my point of view, he doesn't seem to be one bit frightened of any threat from anybody, government, strangers. And I'm here to back them. I know the rest of us are. But there's other pastors out there that are bowing down. They're bowing down to this worldliness that we have here. And if our small body here has to be the beacon to go out to other churches, to go out to other places, to get people to understand that we cannot take God out of our country, that by taking God out of our country, we are plummeting. We are losing ground. If we have to be, to Pastor Duane's example, the aircraft carrier that sends people out to get that message out, then let us be that. Let us be that. Thank you, everyone.